Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
On a pitch-black, starless night, a solitary man was trudging along the main road from Marchiennes to Montsou, 10 kilometres of cobblestones, running straight as a die across the bare plain between fields of beet. He could not even make out the black ground in front of him, and it was only the feel of the March wind blowing in great gusts like a storm at sea, but icy cold from sweeping over miles of marshes and bare earth, that gave him a sensation of limitless, flat horizons. There was not a single tree to darken the sky, and the cobbled high road ran on with the straightness of a jetty through the swirling sea of black shadows. Didn't go with T.S. Eliot today.
Zola.
Bit of Emile Zola. Yeah. Yep, that was from that's the opening paragraph of Germinal, which is
Hommage au pavé.
Hommage au pavé, which is one of Zola's great novels, because he wrote a dozen novels in the towards the end of the 19th century that all interconnect loosely, that follow in various different settings and generations, follow the fortunes of a fictional family whose branches sort of spread out in all these different ways, and most of whom end up living in kind of miserable circumstances.
It's like a 19th century Marvel universe.
Yeah, kind of, but hyper realistic, because Zola had his massive social conscience sort of thing. So a lot of his heroes, main characters, they're all deeply flawed and human. I mean, that was his whole shtick. You know, he's a humanist in many ways. So he wrote according to sort of almost scientific principles. He said that the job of an author is very similar to the job of a scientist. It is to record and observe human nature,
to dissect the human condition.
So he said in the same way that a scientist will set up an experiment where they'll define the parameters in which they put certain phenomena or objects and see what then arises as a result of that, you know, those conditions in which it finds itself. That's exactly what he does with his characters. So he says, I will place the hero of Germinal is a man called Etienne. I will place him in this environment, and then he will the environment will determine what happens next, and I'm simply there to record it. And the particular environment in which Etienne is placed in Germinal is the coal mines, minefields of northern France. One of which I was at, the Arenberg Forest, the coal mine that's just outside the entrance to the Arenberg Forest, that was first discovered by Jean Stablinski when Jean-Marie Leblanc was running out of pavé for Paris-Roubaix, because one by one all the sectors that they had been using historically were getting tarmacked in the 90s, early 1990s, or even late 80s. No, it must have been early 90s. And he turned to Jean Stablinski, because Stablinski came from the coal mines of northern France, and he said, do you know any more? No, do you know any other sectors of pavé that we could use? And he went, yeah.
As a matter of fact, I do.
Said, the one that I used to have to ride over to get to work.
Wow.
The forest of the Arenberg.
So your commute to Arenberg.
Well, actually, I don't think Stablinski himself used to commute, but his wife used to, because they lived in Wallers, and she worked in a factory the other side of the forest of Arenberg. So she used to have to ride over the Arenberg Trench to go to work every day and ride back again.
That's
on whatever bike that she took.
That's so cool.
But it's just coincidence that I just started reading on the train this morning, Germinal, And the first paragraph just said to me, Paris-Roubaix.
I'd love to have seen you on the train, because you came in this morning, you had like a scarf around your neck, your corduroy jacket, reading Emile Zola.
Glasses perched on the edge of my nose.
Look at you, the intellect. I love it.
But Daniel, it's a beautiful bit of writing. It's beautifully translated as well.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Good theme change.
Today on the bike race, today was bleak.
It was bleak. It was
in all sorts of ways, I thought.
It's on the list of Christian van der Velde's hates of Paris-Nice is the fact it's not the race to the sun, it's often the race to the rain. And today exemplified that. It was horrible. What, 10 degrees down in Nice? What is it at the top here? Three degrees.
Probably colder than that now.
And a lot of it was in the rain. I mean, it did look horrible. Riders just getting dropped on descents, giving up, which is how the ASO official website describes riders who stop the bike race because of their suffering. And
I don't know why we find that so funny, but we do. We had a good old chuckle about it today. I think particularly because
Pierre Latour gives up.
It was Pierre Latour and Anthony Turgis have given up. It's a funny choice of words, isn't it? I just give up.
Yeah, it's so good. Well, I gave up. What do we say? It's like I packed, I stopped. Yeah, I DNF'd. Yeah, I gave up.
On the old Twitter as well, I really enjoyed this morning news that broke of Arnaud Demare's giving up. And I just thought it was great, so I kind of translated it. It was actually the Arkea B&B Hotel's official Twitter that came up with this phrase. En regard des conditions météorologiques difficiles annoncées ce week-end, Arnaud Demare, qui présentait hier au soir les signes d'un léger refroidissement, ne sera pas au départ de la septième étape de Paris-Nice. Oh. It just is so elaborate.
I know.
It means, with regard to the difficult meteorological conditions announced for this weekend, Arnaud Demare, who presented yesterday evening with signs of a light chill, will not be at the stage at the start of stage 7 of Paris-Nice. It's like they've got Emile Zola to write their Twitter.
But also, France, a light chill is like the beginning of the end of days. That's when they're all wearing scarves and like four jumpers and like heating on maximum and drinking hot tea. Yeah. And it's just like, it's the tiniest, tiniest hint of maybe you've got a cold, and all of a sudden it's like, that's it. You've got to be like hermetically sealed.
Do you think that's why they haven't won the World Tour stage
race? Oh, yeah, this stat's amazing. So
you did it on the commentary, but it's worth
Christophe Moreau, who was a rider of my generation, was the last French rider to win a World Tour general classification race.
Shut up. It was Moreau.
Moreau, 17 years ago. And since then, 241 World Tour GC races have taken place. And France have not won one of them.
Wow. I knew it was bad. I didn't know it was that bad.
It's really bad, isn't it?
What did Moreau win? Was it Dauphiné?
Dauphiné, I think.
17 years ago, around about 2006, something like that.
Yeah, 2007. Whew. That's intense.
Crikey.
Yeah.
Crikey. Yeah. Blimey.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a perma crisis. That's a crisis multiplier.
That's a deep, deep trough.
That's like English football.
That is like English football. Yeah.
Isn't it? But without the promise of English football, because, you know, the last few years, English football has looked
quite good.
Well,
it's just permanently in promise, isn't it?
It's quite so. There are some similarities, because the Premier League is where the world comes to play.
So Tour de France, yeah.
Like the Tour de France. Yeah. But they can't get even close to winning it. Not even close.
No. And it's the home of football.
Yeah.
France, the home of cycling.
Yeah. Yeah. Christophe Moreau. What was he like?
He was nice.
Nice guy?
Yeah, he was a nice guy. Quite old school. He was quite articulate and a borderline flamboyant character.
Right.
I wish he spoke English, because I think he'd be pretty funny in English.
Yep.
I remember actually, this would be the Dauphiné in maybe 2001 maybe. And me and him went over the backside of Vontoux. And we were like, there were four riders in front of us. We were both kind of racing GC, and we both could like take leader's jersey in the time trial, because it's a flat time trial the next day or something. And so then me and him were chasing back on to the front group on the normal side down to Bedouin.
Yep.
It was the fastest descent I've ever done. Me and him were just absolute. And we got back on, and we both got to the bottom and just looked at each other with that look of, what did we just do? It was like, we were just like tucked up, coming by each other, just going over 100 Ks an hour in the straight sections. And it was just terrifying.
Yeah.
And we just both got to the bottom, got back onto the group, and just looked at each other and didn't say anything. And we're like,
yeah,
that was insane.
Oh, fun. I can imagine. I don't think I've ever ridden down that side, but I can imagine that being terrifying.
Oh yeah, there are sections.
I mean, the first seven sections of the descent are quite sinuous, aren't they?
Yeah.
And after you get past Chalet Renard, some of those sections are very straight.
And it's kind of tail cross, because normally it's kind of that sort of heady cross going up that section where it's all open, sort of tailwind going down it. Oh, so it was just wild. It was a lot of fun. But yeah, it was one of those ones you got to the bottom was like, did we really need to take that many risks?
Did you take the leader's jersey in the time trial?
I think I did. So in which case that would be, yeah, it must be 2001, I think. And then I lost it. I think I got dropped. First rider dropped the next day on the next climb. Ah. That time trial, I remember this. I got second in the time trial to Vorters.
Jonathan Vorters.
The pan flat time trial. So it actually might have been 99, 2000. And I got into the camping car afterwards, because we didn't have buses, because it was still ghetto cycling. And I just climbed in the back and fell asleep immediately before the podium. And obviously, it wasn't the days either where we had recovery shakes and fueling.
Yeah.
So I just emptied my tank, passed out in the back of the car. They woke me up to go to the podium. And clearly, I just didn't fuel or anything, because then the next day, I was completely empty. And I was in the leader's jersey. And before the race had even kicked off, on a climb out of, I can't remember, Grenoble or somewhere. And I was just like dropped. First rider dropped
in on the leader's jersey.
In the leader's jersey. Just nothing. Empty. I was like, okay, oh, that's embarrassing.
David Millard, the leader.
Yeah, the days before nutritional science.
Yeah, I can imagine that you just so your post-race routine was pretty much non-existent.
Yeah, have some syrup and water or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then a massage a bit later.
Yeah. Yeah. Not have anything for like 2 hours after the race with the podium just and control. And like, old days.
Yeah.
But today's race, so you've just been bagging today's race big time, haven't you?
It wasn't great, was it?
No.
It wasn't great. I mean, hats off to a few riders, really. Hats off to Alexander Vlasov. He picked his moment, didn't he? But there's something curiously...
underwhelming.
Underwhelming about a rider like Alexander Vlasov doing a ride like that, isn't there? Because he's only allowed to because he's at 2 minutes and 42 seconds and kind of not quite there, and Borel Hansgrohe have been a bit underwhelming, and so it's consolation, but that's kind of all it is.
Sula Quickstep were a bit better, but just couldn't make a difference.
Yeah.
And so by the time Vivekkor did most of the climb, but just came to a standstill. Who was it? I think, it was Ineos Grenadiers that took over.
Yeah.
Still believing in Bernal, and then it was Van Wilder that took over again and delivered Remco, but it just wasn't enough. Remco attacked, and Vlasov countered, and that was that.
That was a story. I mean, I think the story of Paris-Nice has been Jorgensen, actually.
He looks great. Really good.
On balance.
He was
regardless,
really
almost
today.
Regardless of what happens tomorrow, where he could...
It was only four seconds off GC. He
could take the jersey.
Yeah.
You were a bit critical of him. Well, not critical. You were just sort of wondering why he didn't commit to his move. Well, his...
Well, yellow jersey had been... So they were inside 2Ks to go, 2.5Ks to go, and McNulty cracked... And just cracked and was about 50 meters off the back of the group of five riders. Buitrago, Evenepoel, Jorgensen, and Skelmos. And Remco again was doing Remco. And then I think Jorgensen realized that yellow jersey was back and he started riding on the front. But then he kind of paused and was asking for help with 1.5 Ks to go. And it was like, it doesn't matter now, just take it to the line because you forget about the stage.
Yeah.
You can take the yellow jersey. And he didn't. He kind of put that pause of a few, like probably 200 or 300 meters, where I was a little bit hesitation of what to do. That could have been those 4 seconds.
He's had a fascinating career, Mathieu Jorgensen. He's had a really model career that he himself can give himself great credit for having structured, because and it's brilliant where he's ended up. He's biggest team in the world.
Yeah,
he's at Visma Lisa Bike, and
he definitely took the road less traveled.
He could be about to win Paris-Nice.
Yeah,
which is right up there with the next tier. I mean, you know, if you win Paris-Nice, the next step is a Grand Tour.
Yeah.
But to do that, he's gone via the AG2R development team. And look, isn't this telling that AG2R took one look at him and went,
Yeah, that's true.
Not sure there's a contract there.
So he went to Movistar.
So he went to he offered his own services to Movistar. He said, "Look, I'm all right. I'm quite good." And they went, "Dah, we don't sign Americans," because they kind of, you know, this is a few years ago when they really didn't sign Americans. And he went, "It's okay, I'll learn Spanish. I've already learned it." You know, so he kind of like he did actually go to a lot of trouble to learn good Spanish, so he could be part of that team properly.
And I think I read somewhere that last year he was just invested a lot of his own money in training camps and coaching and everything. So he was basically
funding himself. Not very much money at Movistar,
and just funding his own kind spending of training. Yeah, which is amazing.
And last year, this time last year, he was winning. He won his first race. He won Oman. Won the Queen stage in Oman and then took the GC.
He's an interesting rider because he's
a big progression in a year.
Because he's got that kind of, I'd almost go as far as saying old school Grand Tour racer, where he's kind of that real all rounder. You know,
you've seen him in the classics.
Yeah,
you know, he's great.
He's amazing.
Really competitive.
Strong as. I mean, he's got that. He is a brilliant time trialist. But the way he's climbing here, good racer. I mean, the way we saw him race yesterday, it's instinctive. The Tour de France last year, where he almost won that stage as well. It was that was amazing.
Yeah,
I know. I think I got a lot of time for him. I think he's a brilliant bike racer.
Yeah, me too.
I didn't realize that him and McNulty were so close.
Right. That was interesting.
Super interesting. Yeah. So the two of them off the front yesterday. It was like when they were juniors, just decimating fields.
Yeah.
The first European experience when they were 14 was together.
Yeah. And then old Matteo gave an interview to Daniel, said, "Look, listen, when we were kids, Brandon just ripped my head off. He was way better than me. Way better than me. But year on year, bit by bit, I've kind of got stronger." So he's caught him up. And today, he couldn't take the jersey off him. It's actually a crazy story, the two of them.
It's a great one. Yeah.
And hats off to McNulty, actually, for clinging on and defending that jersey.
Yeah, I actually had a feeling he'd crack much earlier than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not looking good for UAE, actually. They're kind of doing a little bit like they did, because obviously I know everything about UAE Tour because I was there. It was a very similar scenario as the week progressed. They just started to crumble more and more.
Yeah.
And again today, Almeida kind of wasn't there, dropped. Groschartner wasn't there. McNulty was isolated. So there's still more Sudal Quickstep riders there than UAE in the final, which is unexpected.
Yeah, yeah.
Considering we were bagging Sudal Quickstep yesterday. But I think it's a very, very big ask. Because actually, as well, because everyone's seen McNulty today, they know it's all to play for tomorrow. Because it seems unlikely that McNulty will be able to hang on, because tomorrow's a savage stage. And Remco, I mean, he could be just sort of biding his time for tomorrow. The amount of times we've seen Paris-Nice unfold on the final day.
Yeah.
Could be battle royale.
Yeah. I mean, the GC is much more scrunched up now, isn't it?
I'm surprised.
Back together again. So Remco's just outside 30 seconds. 36 seconds.
Yeah.
Off the jersey. I'm not sure, though. I don't know. I think Jorgensen can go with him.
Jorgensen, I think he can,
You know? From what we've seen, Remco would have to go someone to actually get rid of Jorgensen on the showings. I think Jorgensen will win Paris-Nice. There we go.
All right.
I've made a prediction. How stupid of me.
Why don't you make a money prediction on it?
Because I wouldn't get much money for that, would I? I don't think.
That's true, actually.
And the last money prediction I made was on that darts player who wasn't drinking and didn't work.
Yeah.
Money prediction. So that's that. Oh, yeah, McNulty. I made a bit of an arse about it. I said, he's Texan yesterday, didn't I? And I knew the minute I said he's Texan, I knew that was wrong, which is why I confused myself by saying... Somebody on Twitter said it was pure never strays far when I said, but there's Brandon McNulty, the Texan. Which part of Arizona is he from? or something like that.
No, you said Tucson. Tucson, that's in Arizona.
Which part of Texas is he from? Tucson, but that's in Arizona. Anyway, he's from Phoenix.
So you're half right.
That was the bit that I couldn't. Yeah, not really, but no, because at no point did I say Phoenix.
But you figured it was
Arizona. I called him a Texan and then wondered whether he was from Tucson, so I wasn't half right at all. Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah, that's a strange place for a cyclist to come from.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
But we like Brandon McNulty. We like him because he looks permanently startled by life.
Yeah, I mean, he does, and he does look like a Second World War pilot. It looks like he's just come back from a bombing raid. And he's just survived by the skin of his teeth.
He looks
and
come out playing. He's got an old
fashioned
face.
He's in a debriefing permanently after like a bombing raid. Just what happened up there, Brandon? Can't talk about it.
He's got like a 1,000-yard stare.
Yeah.
He's just reliving it all.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're right, he's got an old fashioned face though, isn't he?
He's got a very old fashioned face. I mean, I'd like to see, actually, here's a challenge for Twitter. Somebody to AI Brandon McNulty into a Second World War forces pilot. That would be brilliant. He'd look great.
In a debrief.
Yeah, in a debrief.
After having done a bombing raid.
With a UAE team.
With
and Jay Vine.
Finn Fisher Black.
Jay Vine's got a tash as well, so he'd look great.
He'd look quite good. And Finn Fisher Black would be the pilot, wouldn't he? Because he's quite a good looking lad.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the flash
and
guy.
He's that sort of like no bullshit Antipodean.
Yeah.
Kind of just like rolling with it.
So Fisher Black would be the pilot. Almeida would be the little navigator guy.
Yeah.
Like just beavering away in his little bit there.
Yeah. McNulty's in a turret gunner.
Totally. Taylor Charlie is just at the back. Gunning his way through everything, like eyes out on stalks. Niels Pollitt?
Oh.
Babe Bombay. He'd be doing all the heavy lifting sort of thing. Like, doing all that sort of stuff.
Pulling the pins.
Or maybe just, he might not get airborne.
I was actually going to say he's a ground staff. Yeah.
He'd be raving them off as they go off on their GC bombing raid.
Pulling out the blocks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Refueling.
Dungarees. Big dungarees kind of thing.
Yeah.
Big overalls.
Totally. Like, none of the guys, when they got onto the plane, would look at him particularly or know his name. None of them bothered to learn his name. But he's just the guy.
And he'd be like, you know, when Pete was describing when he kind of does the job reversals when he's waiting around all day for him to come back and he's all excited.
Yeah.
That'd be Niels Pollitt with that big smile.
Yeah.
Welcoming them all. They're all just coming out, falling out of the plane. And Niels is there.
He'd try to high-five them all.
Just been left hanging.
UAE as a US Air Force bombing crew.
That's so what was your your interesting facts for today, Ned?
Oh, a barrel load, David. Shall I start?
Yeah.
I might as well, otherwise we'll never finish. I went off on a deep dive today, one way and another. Oh, but first of all, can I mention that, so you're probably going to be listening to this tomorrow on Sunday. If you're listening to it on Monday, it's too late. But if you're listening to it tonight on Saturday night, or indeed on Sunday during the day, Sunday is the last day you can take advantage of the extraordinary roadbook discounts that we've got. Let me get this out of the way. 50% off the 2022 volume. That includes some signed editions as well. Enter the discount code RED22 or 20% off any of the collection from 2018 to 2021 volumes. RETRO20 is the discount code for that. And if you want, because we're just ordering the reprints of 2023, which completely sold out, if you want to get yourself in the waiting list for those and get them delivered as soon as you can, email us at office@theroadbook.co.uk. Right, facts, David, facts. The finishing line today, yeah?
Yeah.
The Madone d'Utel.
Yeah.
Is a rather underwhelming looking sanctuary, a little chapel to Mary.
Yeah.
Virgin Mary at the top of this little climb, the Madone d'Utel. And the story of it is that the reason that a sanctuary was established there in the first place was because in the year 850, a Spanish vessel was approaching the coastline at exactly the point where the River Var flows out into the Mediterranean and the French Riviera. And a storm blew up. And they all got down on the deck and prayed to God for salvation. And as part of their prayers, they said, if we survive this one, we'll establish a sanctuary on the top of that hill. They could see it. It's one of the first hills they could see. So as they looked up the river valley, and we'll build it there to the Virgin Mary. And by a miracle, they were saved from the storm. And so they established a sanctuary there. But it's a long time ago. The year 850, and so they didn't build the sanctuary that we see now, which looks like it's a kind of Renaissance building. The first thing that was built up there architecturally was what's known as a pylon, which intrigued me because I didn't really know architecturally what a pylon was. I think of pylons as being those metal things that carry electric. But actually, there's an architectural term, pylon, which relates to, it's actually ancient Egyptian architecture, which must have found its way through to the Iberian Peninsula as well in terms of its influence in the, in the 9th century. But a pylon is like two slightly pyramidal structured towers that sit alongside one another, allowing for a little sort of gateway or a portal in between. That's known as a pylon, and you'll see it a lot in ancient Egypt and I think in ancient Greece as well. And the reasoning why it looks like that, partly what it represents, is that there's a hieroglyphic symbol, come on to symbols as well, it's got some other stuff about symbols, that resembles this shape of these two towers, which stands for rebirth or reincarnation. And the two towers represent the, this that also relates to the T.S. Eliot quote we had yesterday, represents the sun rising and then the sun setting. So the idea that this happens in a cyclical thing is a is a constant rebirth and reincarnation. But anyway, at some point that shrine that was built in that sort of form fell into ruin, but the sanctuary, the idea of a sanctuary remains to
look at that.
And that climb, if you're any, if you ever find yourselves in the French Riviera or holidaying in Nice or Antibes, down that area, look beautiful. Stinking weather today, but it looked like a lovely climb to go up, to go and ride up.
Yeah, and not too hard.
No, it didn't look too hard, did it? No. Just like,
well, not
quite long.
Well, till races go up, it didn't look too hard.
No, they made it look pretty easy. And when and on a clear day, apparently, when you get up there, the great thing about it is that you can see all the way around 360 degrees from the summit. So the views are astonishing from the top of that climb.
Amazing.
Just outside Nice. That's the one thing that I learned. The other thing is, just before they got to Utel, where the no, actually, just before they got to Saint-Jean de, what was it called? Saint-Jean-la-Rivière, on the road to Saint-Jean-la-Rivière, they went through a little village called Duranas, which is also known as Le Saut des Français. The word saut means the jump or the leap.
Yeah?
The jump of the French. Got its rather bloody, gruesome nickname because in the immediate aftermath of the French Revolution, a number of French soldiers were taken up there and thrown over the edge of a 300-meter cliff to their death in retribution for atrocities that had been visited by the French army on the local population.
Holy moly.
And so it's known as Le Saut des Français.
Oh, there you go.
That's quite gruesome. And here's the here's the last thing that I found out, and this is where I really went down a rabbit hole, David. In Utel itself, which we didn't really get very many nice shots of, it. It's where the intermediate sprint was. Really old little hilltop village perching on the side of the mountain, and it's on some the signs of some of the old medieval buildings that are still there, you can make out sigils engraved into the walls, and sigil is spelt S-I-G-I-L, right? What's a sigil, you may well ask?
Yes.
Thank you. A sigil is an ancient pagan magic sign which appeared on these buildings because it was part of the belief system that medieval alchemists used to go about their business. So these sigils are occult signs that represent angels and demons, and date back centuries and centuries and centuries. They're still, you can still see them in the side of buildings, just scratched in. They're like little circles with little details and bits and pieces in like that. That's an old sigil, a medieval sigil.
What was the purpose of them?
Well, they belong to a kind of like occult belief system.
What, to say we believe in this, you're safe here?
Yeah, or kind of invoking the spirit or you know, or paying respects to a demon so that you keep the demon far hence, or perhaps invoking the angel's spirit.
Like pagan?
So, yeah, so kind of like yeah, a different, whole different universe of gods and belief systems that were kind of part of medieval life and part of alchemy, but also in one way and another have morphed and persisted through various different iterations of human understanding right through until, and here's where the rabbit hole really goes deep, right? Right through until the beginning of the 20th century when a British artist from London, a guy called Austin Osman Spare, as in spare tire or spare part, in the early 19th century, who was born into poverty in London, got a place to study at the Royal Academy of Arts and became a lot of his art, if you see it, features kind of like erotica and weird monstrous visions and kind of animals like that. But he was an occultist. And he then, he is the founding father of what became known as the theory of chaos magic, right? Which a lot of people worldwide, but particularly in Britain, believe in. And it's an old kind of like late 20th century updated version of the occult.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Chaos magic. And an offshoot of the kind of chaos magic belief system, which got a new lease of life in the early 1970s when people rediscovered the beliefs and the writing and the drawing of Austin Osman Spare. an offshoot of that was in 1981 when a group was founded called the Temple of Psychic Youth, right? By a man called Genesis P. Orridge, as in porridge.
Without a P.
But it's just like Genesis P. dot Orridge. So Genesis Porridge, I think you said Genesis Porridge founded the Temple of Psychic Youth.
Jesus.
In 1981, who are a series occultists to this day, and there, if you are one of the Temple of Psychic Youth, on the 23rd hour at 11 o'clock at night, on the 23rd day of every month, you have to indulge in psychic activities. And occasionally they will call on the members of their particular church as well to draw sigils, these symbols, and pop them in an envelope and send them all to a certain address where they collect their psychic energy in one spot, and they can do things in that spot to influence
that's amazing.
The planet.
Love chaos magic.
Yeah. They also believe that the kind of like, so that's a long time ago, 1981, what is that, 40 years ago. They also believe quite strongly that the modern day sigils in the world are put there for a reason, and they can cite the both the arches of McDonald's and the Nike swoosh as modern day
Illuminati.
Yeah, sigils.
Imagine if the golden arches were a sigil. Brilliant.
Isn't it good?
The golden arches.
But old Austin Osman Spare, who kind of got the whole ball rolling in the 20th century and kind of reinvented occultism and the belief in sigils quite specifically, he invented a new way of drawing and creating sigils and all this sort of thing. But he also was a big exponent of automatic writing and automatic drawing.
So you don't look at the page or something?
Yeah, it just happens. You know, like being possessed.
Yes.
So all the more reason, I tell you, to go to the little village of Utel to
dig
out the sigils. Yeah. All that, I made all those notes. I didn't get any of that out in the commentary, even though I could have done, because there wasn't much going on in the race.
I know, but... Well, it just took quite a long time in the podcast, didn't it? I hope
there it is.
Oh, it's gone.
Yeah.
I hope you've got cookies turned on in your browser, because you'll be totally throwing Google at the moment.
what's he doing now?
Trying to pigeonhole you. What are we targeting with?
Maybe that's why my Spotify suggests are so random. Oh, by the way, I listened to the new Nick Cave song the other day. I put that as absolutely brilliant. It's called Wild God. Listen to it on the way back.
I will.
And wait for the chorus kicking in at 3 minutes and 12 seconds.
All right.
When it kicks in, it goes boom.
Oh, does it?
It's absolutely incredible, yeah.
Oh, I love that. Okay, yeah. I will.
Yeah. So there we go. You did a bit of shopping today?
Did a bit of shopping. Back on got some kids, some trainers.
Nice.
They seem to go, kids go through shoes so quick.
Well, they're growing, David.
Well, no, they wear them out.
Yeah, that's true.
Especially Harvey. He just like thrashes shoes. Right. I don't know what he's doing.
Right.
Obviously a lot of movement.
Yeah. Yeah,
I did that. Did a park run.
Oh, yeah?
Did a park run.
Which one?
Gunnersbury. I made the decision this morning because I was down in Wimbledon. I do go do Wimbledon Common because I've never done that. And I thought, no, I'm going to ride in to the studio.
To warm up.
And it was really nice. I came in here, pitch black, no one here.
Wait. It was dark when you arrived here?
No, pitch black in the studio.
I was going to say, because it's light by 6:30 now.
No, it was a lovely ride in, blue skies. Came in here and I felt like, well, first here, that's never happened before. Put on my running gear, went down to Gunnersbury Park. There were like 500 people.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I did the run, which was nice. And
where did you finish?
6th.
That's very good, David.
It was fun.
Did you win your age group?
No, it's dude older than me. I looked.
Yeah. Older and faster?
Yeah. Well, I mean, 10 seconds faster, but...
That's faster.
Yeah. and then just walked back up here. It was a lovely morning, actually. Yeah. I'm glad I did it.
I must admit, I was flabbergasted. I came in pretty early this morning. I saw your Brompton just leaning up against the wall. Saw that you'd vacated. There's some clothes strewn over the back of your commentary seat. And there was a coffee that you'd obviously picked up on your way in.
I know.
What's David doing?
I know. It was mad. Left at like 7:30.
2 hours before the race even began.
Yeah. I don't know. Actually, I had to really make myself do it, which was made it even better.
You know,
forcing myself.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I'm glad I did that. Last thing I want to do, best thing for you.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Done a lot of sport this week.
Very good.
Yeah.
We should answer a Twitter inquiry that I said I'd answer and then forgot to answer last week. Maybe you can help me answer this. Why is Gary introducing the show from a cafe?
Changing it up, adding a bit more colour to the show. And also, I think if you're going to do special effects and studio and stuff, you either do it with like a six-figure budget.
Seven-figure budget.
Yeah, you're right. Seven-figure budget. And do it better than everybody else. Do it like Premier League.
Yeah.
Or just don't.
Just stand in front of the cafe.
Yeah. I think it's much more cycling as well.
Yeah, I agree.
I think it's much more close, give a bit of real-world colour to it.
Yeah. Well, I think veteran viewers of the Dauphiné coverage in Paris-Nice over the last few years will have been aware that...
Wasn't a seven-figure budget.
Wasn't a seven-figure with a green screen. Can you describe how big it was or how not big it was? How many table tennis tables could you have got there?
Three.
Three maximum? Yeah.
You're gonna play. One to play.
Yeah, because you'd have to get round it.
Yeah. I'd say one actually.
Right.
You couldn't have two table tennis matches going on at the same time in it before.
And I think what might have killed any sense that green screen was in any way broadcastable or appropriate was when GCN and Eurosport kind of upped their game just in terms of green screen.
Yeah, metaverse.
I mean, they just have... It's the metaverse. You're going to have Blythe and Lloydie and Orla just wearing virtual goggles or whatever they're called. Apple virtual, just in your room with you. Just stand, sitting on the couch next to you.
That would be weird.
Just appearing there.
Yeah, gliding. Dancing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Their tech just left.
No, just like, no.
Just left you and Gary looking...
We're about the racing, Ned. We prioritise the racing. And Gary does a bit of colour around it.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And that's the reason.
And that's how we do it.
Yeah. Oh, we did have quite a lengthy suggestion about merch that came in on our email address, really? Which is... what is our email address?
Hello@neverstraysfar.com.
I check it occasionally, and it popped up today. Where is it? Hilary McGeechy writes, entitled NSF Merch. Dear Ned, David and Pete, I've listened to Never Strays Far and read your books. Pete... Looking forward to yours one day.
Good.
For years. Oh.
Nudge.
I got a bit of grief that when I revealed my surprise that you'd lived in Nice.
That revealed you hadn't read
that
book.
That revealed that I hadn't read your book. That's not true. I've read your book. I read it a bloody long time ago.
That's fair. Ned, I don't begrudge you.
When did you publish it? 2011?
2011.
13 years ago. I read it as soon as it came out. I was champing at the beer.
Thanks, Ned.
Yeah. But I just can't remember that particular bit.
Went over it quite quickly, to be fair.
Okay. read your books, Pete. Looking forward to yours one day. Love it. I am the reasonably uncluttered Venn diagram of Never Strays Far listeners comprising Australian, female, living in India.
Nice.
Yeah, I reckon you're in a group of one.
Yeah.
I'd be very interested in knowing if anyone else is in Hillary's Venn diagram subset of Australian female and living in India. That's, by the way, on the subject of merchandise, bucket hats, !! Yes. I think everyone loves bucket hats.
We've got to do bucket hats.
And they're very Pete and, I like a bucket hat.
I used to love wearing a bucket hat.
Bucket hats. And in more than one size. And that's a lifelong plea from the large meloned So Hillary is claiming a significant cranium. Mm. A range of T-shirts with the Never Strays Far logo in three different types. It's quite specific in her design request here. E.g., using each of your numbers from, say, the Plank Attack.
Which is number age?
50.
42.
30. In other words, create an indirect competition among you. I don't really understand that. That should create some fun neuroses on a few episodes until they all sell. Oh, I see.
Oh, who wants what?
Print
most?
50 of my ones.
Yeah.
42 of yours and 30 and see who sells out first. Is that what
should we do with our current age then? 47.
Yeah, could do. It makes it more ambitious. That should sell. That should create some fun neuroses on a few episodes until they all sell, because of course they will. T-shirt, tagline, Where's Pete?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Simple. And surely there's a Christmas range to be had. Pete's excited. T-shirts in 90s, this is very much your sort of thing. T-shirts in 90s washed out fluoro or some other garish colour. Sod the good taste. Nice. Regards, Hillary.
That's good. That's actually a nice little...
Yeah, it's very detailed and very interesting.
Merching advice.
And just good to know that we've got a female Australian listener in India as well. I'm just checking the Twitter to see if anything else has come in, merch suggestion wise. Brilliant, love the jacket. I really love you. Podding cancer. Here we go. I have a pronunciation question. I am new to cycling and was wondering who Bernardino was. I finally realised it was Bernardino, but is it not pronounced Bernardino? Yeah. Bernardino. Do you roll the D on? Bernardino?
Bernardino. You know?
It's a good question. I don't actually know the answer to
that. Bernardino.
Loving the pod as ever, says Paul Watson, especially the rider's musical instrument chat. Merch-wise, I think a T-shirt with partly peeled orange and Are You Not Entertained might be up there. Mm. Or a Pete's Notebook. Pete's Notebook's
it's
getting
a lot
of it's mentions.
A lot. Yeah.
And I think that'd be quite easy to do as well.
It's just Pete's words.
With a pod word cloud on the back. Like it. Sidoni says, I always have to chuckle when I hear you say, should we talk about the bike race? More often than not, halfway through the podcast. Well, that wasn't the case on today's podcast.
Not much sharing Paranese, I'd like to say.
We got straight into it. NS Never Stray So Far. Bidons, that's a suggestion. Tom West, for a merch idea, it would be good to have all three of you in a silhouette with the three of you holding a pizza box with Never Stray So Far on the back. I don't really understand that one, but thanks for the suggestion. How about, for those of us who don't like slogans on our T-shirts, designs based on just the Never Strays Far logo?
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Cheers, Mike. I think we've got that on offer, haven't we?
Yeah, we do.
At the moment.
Or does it still say it's normal?
Oh, I might do. Yeah. Right. And that is pretty much it.
Well, I got a lot to work with.
Yeah. Andy Steele, T-shirt idea. Never Strays Far. Brought to you by, with a sign underneath that says open to sponsorship contact, podcast email here. Very good. Very good. Although, hopefully, we got some news on that coming up
hopefully
soon.
Shortly.
All right.
All right, very good.
One more of these to go.
Good day tomorrow.
Record downloads. Thank you very much, folks.
Yes.
It's going well. Yeah, more of you.
And I saw loads of reviews. I saw on your Twitter. That's nice.
Yeah, nice. Everyone's reviews are really good. Yeah. That helps the algorithm as well. So if you want to be nice on that.
You don't know that.
And I do.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, it's actually true.
Oh, is it? Oh, in that case, please, everyone, if you haven't already, or if you have, just do it again.
The number of reviews and the numbers of stars on that affect your algorithm and the way that you...
Listeners, please support Never Strays Far and do that. Reviewers, starers.
Cool. All right.
Thanks.
See you tomorrow.